this week on BSD Now. First up, we got a wrap-up from New York City BSD Con that Alan went to over the weekend. We'll also be talking to Luke Marsden, CEO of Hybrid Cluster, about how they use BSD at large. And following that, of course, a tutorial. We're going to be showing you how to securely share files with SFTP and a Cheroot. Oh, that's neat. We also got some latest news and answers to your questions. Of course, it's all on BSD Now, the place to be, SD. Episode 24, The Cluster in the Cloud, recorded February 12th, 2014. Hey, I'm your host, Chris Moore.
And I'm Alan Jude.
Hey, we're glad to have you guys with us this week. We got some cool info to start off the show with. I guess Alan went out to a New York City BSD Con this last weekend and is going to give us a little bit of feedback on how'd that go. So how was it, Alan?
It was really good, actually. We had quite a bit of fun. They had quite a few talks as well. You pull up the schedule here, you can see they had Drew Levine started off with a little bit about ZFS and managing it on FreeNAS and PCBSD, kind of given the two different ways to do it. And that was quite good and well-received. There were quite a few questions about stuff.
Of course.
Somebody was wondering why your tools don't support Zvols yet.
Nobody's gotten around to writing. The best answer.
There's not that much use for Zvols on a desktop.
No, and it's more one of those things. When somebody says they want Zvols, usually they're doing something that they're going to do with the command prompt anyway. Yeah. So we haven't had to have support for it in the GUI. Yeah. Although I imagine at some point we will. It's just not a super used thing at the moment.
Yeah. And then Ray Percival gave a talk interconnecting with BSDs. It's basically why all routers should be BSD. Who hasn't had to use some other router and at some point just wished that they could run, you know, a TCP dump on the router?
Yeah.
To see.
I know the command that would do this, but, you know, this router doesn't.
And he talked a bit about NSH, which is a tool that it's a shell for, like, OpenBSD and so on, that gives you the Cisco-like commands so that when people that are used to working on a Cisco and don't know Unix as well, we'd still be able to use a Unix-based router.
Oh, that's kind of cool. Is that in the FreeBSD port stream?
I think so.
Okay. We may well have to include that.
Yeah, and then Andrew Wong gave his talk about FreeBSD with ZFS for Postgres. So, you know, how to use a database and how compression actually makes your database faster. Because if you have, say, 100 megabytes of data and you're writing it to the drive, well, if you compress it down to, you know, even 70,
60 megs.
Yeah, 60 megs. Yeah. Then you only have to write 60 megs to the disk. So you just wrote 100 megs in the time it takes to write 60 megs.
Sure.
Well, and means when you're reading it back, you can read it back faster, right? Because you read 60 megs and you've read 100 megs. So it means you can actually, especially, you know, databases tend to be full of text and really compressible information.
Oh, yeah.
You can read at speeds that would just be physically incapable of the computer doing. You know, with LZ4, you can get decompression ratios of like 1 or 2 gigabytes per second per core.
Yeah.
If you got a nice 24-core server and enough disk bandwidth and enough compressible data, you can do all kinds of things.
A lot of people, I don't think, realize yet, too, that LZ4 compression, there's no real hit for turning it on because it'll check when it first starts the compression if this is compressible data, and if not, just write it as is.
Yeah. I forget what the time amount it does, but yeah, if it's written after it tries so much of the data, it tastes it or whatever, if the compression is less than 12.5%, it just doesn't bother.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't burn CPU cycles doing nothing.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, there's no brainer. I mean, we turn that on by default everywhere.
Exactly.
Just because there's no reason not to.
That's
anymore.
The best part about LZ4 is now you don't have to create a bunch of data sets and decide what gets compressed. You can compress everything because you compress, you know, your ports dist files full of .tar.xz files. But LZ4 is like, oh, that's not compressible. I won't bother. And so, yeah. And then over lunch, they did a project expose. So they had a bunch of different projects where you go around and see stuff. They had like different embedded stuff with MIPS or using CARP and making redundant routers. Or the BSD certification group had a short little beta test of their the BSD professional exam, which is the practical one rather than the written one. So I tried that out. They were trying it on different people's laptops to see, make sure the hardware and the system works. But basically, I boot up off this external hard drive, start the virtual machine, and do the exam on this virtual machine. And then the marking system SSHs into the virtual machine and checks that all the required things are done, and automatically scores your exam.
Oh, that's cool.
And then ZFS rollback, and it's ready for the next student.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you did is undone.
That's cool. Is that a Drew and Jim Brown showing a little bit of that?
Yes,
or?
That was what that was. And so that was
very nice.
Cool. And then Scott Long gave his talk on serving one third of the internet. It was an updated version of the fairly standard Netflix talk. he also promised that at Asia BSDCon next month, he'll give a more in-depth, you know, kind of aimed at more power users, whereas this was aimed at just everybody kind of thing.
Ooh, nice. I will be attending that talk.
Yes.
That is, I don't miss the Netflix talks.
Well, we both missed the one in Malta, didn't we?
But I think it was the exact same one that they had just done. So we knew that going into it.
Right.
But if he's giving new data, shoot.
Exactly.
No, yeah.
And then Jeff Rizzo from NetBSD did their release engineering and testing framework. And then Michael Lucas gave a talk about getting BSD to break barriers and stuff.
Nice.
And specifically, you've mentioned things like, you know, when you write something for your management to convince them to let you use BSD for something, maybe you could share that with everybody. And generally, writing something that looks more like a white paper is better than writing a one paragraph email. You'll get more attention, and it's more useful for everyone else as well. You know, when you're competing against Cisco or whatever, if they have a white paper, you need to have a white paper.
Yep. Very cool. Needs to look just as professional.
Yeah. And then Justin Sherrill, who's been a guest on the show before, he wrote up some of the stuff from his trip as well.
Very nice. And we'll have the link to that in the show notes afterwards as well.
I harangued George, and I got myself a print copy of the FreeBSD Journal. Yes.
I'm getting mine next month. We're in Tokyo. Yeah. I think he said he's bringing some. Yeah. Cool.
That's out in all the stores now, so you can buy that on with Amazon Kindle Store, the Apple iTunes Store, or the Google Play Store.
Okay, nice. Yeah, check it out. I think you have an article in the first issue there, Alan.
Yep, I do. Do you?
Very cool. I have one coming in the second issue. They're doing one on packaging systems.
Yes, and you have lived that for a while, haven't you?
Yeah. Been there, done that for quite a while now. So, cool.
Yes.
Well, excellent. I'm going to have to go download that and grab my iPad or something, see if we can read that, see how it came out. Cool. Okay, well, I guess we'll get right into the headlines then. So, excellent. First up, we have an article about FreeBSD 10 as a firewall. So back in 2012, an author of this particular site wrote an article saying how you should avoid FreeBSD 9 for a firewall and use OpenBSD instead. But I guess he's changed his mind. Now with the release of 10, he's gone back and switched over. So he's updated the article. We'll have the link in the show notes if you want to take a look at it. But he mentioned some of the stuff about SMP version of PF, general performance advantages, and, of course, more modern features are in 10. So that makes it a worthy candidate.
Yeah. Well, there are some newer features of PF that you can only get in OpenBSD currently. Mm-hmm. The SMP friendliness and the extra patches that went into FreeBSD 10 make PF more performant on FreeBSD, even though it's got the older rule syntax.
Sure. Well, that's cool, though. That's neat to see him go back and update it and give the new release a fair shake.
Yeah, and that came up during the BSD routers talk at New York BSDCon. It's like, well, why would anyone use IPFW anymore? It's like, well, if you're doing really simple stuff, IPFW is even faster.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because, you know, if you have numbered rules and you're parsing them in order, you can stop parsing when you hit certain rule. Like, so if you put rules near the top, there's less code path.
Very quick.
And stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's been tuned really well for the SMP.
Yeah, I still like, I use IPFW for stuff occasionally.
I use it whenever I'm doing something where, if my firewall only needs four rules, IPFW seems to just be easier.
I've done it with traffic shaping as well, so a little dummy net. Okay, really quick, here's 100 kilobytes a second. Done.
Yeah, Michael Lucas had a great anecdote about working for like a car manufacturer or something, and they were building a web app, and they found that it was too slow when users in Europe used it, but the developers in North America, and so with the time difference and work hours and stuff, it meant that he would make a change, send an email. The next day, they would try something and send the email back. And everything. Mm. And so Michael took an old Pentium, put FreeBSD with IPFW and DummyNet on it, and gave the developer a magic cable. And when you plugged into that magic cable, it was as if you were in Bulgaria instead of Michigan.
Yeah, you got the 400 milliseconds latency or whatever.
And like, you know, 2% packet loss.
That's really cool.
Was very useful, yeah.
Well, we want to mention also the author of this article is a regular listener of BSD Now. So, hey, Joe, thank you for updating that. Yes. Very cool. Glad we could link to it and highlight you guys during the news. Cool. So what's the next article we got here, Alan? So, something about network noise?
Yeah, this is from Peter Hanstein, who we've talked about a bit before. He wrote about the Hail Mary cloud and SSH brute forcing done really slowly so that it won't trigger your alarms and stuff. And so he's got a new one, effective spam and malware countermeasures, or network noise reduction using free tools. And it basically a talk about how he uses SpamD and a bunch of other tools in OpenBSD to reduce the amount of CRUD going through his network.
Oh, nice.
By, you know, catching stuff and blocking it.
Mm-hmm. I guess he talks a little bit about proprietary vendors in comparison and his various experiences with content filtering. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we also have an article today about FreeBSD getting some ASLR patches submitted. So for address space layout randomization, for those who didn't know what the acronym was, heck, I had to see what it was too. Yeah.
I only know because I've mentioned it before. So when there's a bug in a program that has like a buffer overflow and you can, you know, write too much data to that block of memory and overwrite something else so that your code get executed. But if the layout of the memory is randomized, you can't ever know or guarantee or reproduce where that buffer overflow is going to happen. So it makes it a lot harder to exploit. So it's an exploit mitigation technique.
Well, that's pretty cool. So I guess it's a pretty cool, as you said, nice security feature. And we have a giant patch now from Sean Webb that may be integrated into a future version, of course, after some review from the security team.
Yep.
But we may have to get a Sean on the show to talk about that, but he's going to be giving a BSD CAN presentation about this as well.
So that's
when we can corner him actually at BSD CAN after he gives his talk right before, kind of get an update for our listeners here on what that's going to do for us.
For sure. It's great to see more stuff like this going in, and I know he's been working on this for quite a while, so.
Well, in today's day and age, everyone's very security conscious now and whatnot, and I think that's a good thing.
Specifically, he also has a feature in there with per jail ASLR configuration. So you can configure ASLR differently for each jail.
Oh, that's neat. Yeah, that's some cool stuff. Mm-hmm. Exciting. Gonna be glad to go hear that talk and sit in on it in a couple months. Cool. Okay, we also have some news about the old-style package tools on FreeBSD have been officially retired.
Yes. Ooh. Well, a date for their deprecation.
Our date has been set, yes.
They're giving you 6 months from a couple days ago.
I guess September 1st is that's all you got until to get moved over to Package NG. But, of course, the ports aren't going away, so if you're a port guy and you've been doing it that way forever, you probably still can forever. But,
yeah, well, you'll have to upgrade your database to Package NG still.
Mm-hmm.
But
correct.
Other than that command and putting a flag in make.conf, there's no difference as far as the ports are concerned, really.
And I'm sure that flag will get pushed into the ports tree or make.conf by default here,
or something like that,
fairly soon. I mean, there's no point in not having it.
Well, I guess the ports tree won't expect
the old style anymore.
Yeah, it won't expect old style anymore. That'll be very good because it'll remove a lot of compatibility crafting and let package take. Quite a few more leaps forward.
Okay.
Which I'm sure will be fun for you.
Yes.
But apparently there's a couple of really compelling features that are held up waiting for the old system to go away.
Nice. Well, that's good. Out with the old and with the new.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, of course, this week we want to mention that this episode is brought to you by IX Systems, and you can check out their site at ixsystems.com/BSDnow to get all the information on how they can build enterprise servers and storage for open source for you to your specific needs. But we also want to mention there's a couple cool things that happened this last week. I guess the first one, they had an interview with Jordan Hubbard.
Yeah, DCIG.com did an interview with Jordan Hubbard on the strengths of the FreeNAS project and what sets it apart. And so that was a very interesting interview. And then, of course, IX Systems is always a big part of the community, so they were also at FOSDEM, and they have posted a whole slew of pictures of...
Like 30 or 40 pictures here I'm looking at. There's a lot. It's neat to see them out there.
Yep.
Oh, they had a big Beastie plushie. That is cool. Yep. I haven't seen that one
And they
before.
Got a Raspberry Pi with a sign pointed at it that says, runs FreeBSD.
Yep. There you go. Yep. Very cool. Mm-hmm. And they also want us to mention that a FreeNAS 9.21 release has been announced.
Yes, that happened, I think, Friday or Saturday. Mm-hmm. Kind of spoiled the news a little bit last week when I mentioned I saw it get uploaded to the FTP site, but it went official on Friday, so it's great to see that.
So upgrade your FreeNAS boxes now. New good stuff.
Yes, and they're already working on 9.22.
Yeah, fantastic.
So if you have any gripes, get them in there, because I guess in the latest one, they fixed 189 bug reports.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's definitely a lot of information here. So
that
check
means,
out the links
post it's,
show.
It's time to submit 189 new ones.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And feature requests, too. Doesn't that be a bug report?
Exactly.
So very cool. Yep. Keep those guys busy, right?
Yep. So if you need a server, whether it's a tiny FreeNAS mini or a giant storage server like I bought, it's like 120 terabytes of storage in it, or on their Facebook a while ago, I saw they had like two or three pallets stacked on top of each other. Some customer bought 400 terabytes of storage.
Yep.
I'm like,
yep.
Ooh, I want that.
Yeah. But the point is they can do all that
the
for
entire,
you. So it can be big or small.
Yeah, the entire scale, whether you need a tiny FreeNAS mini for only a couple $100 or if you need to spend many, many zeros to get many, many zeros of storage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all powered by the great Intel line of processors, whether it's the little i3 in the smallest FreeNAS mini or the E5s and E7s and the giant, four and eight-way servers.
Yep. They can make that happen. Yep. Well, cool. So, again, that URL is ixsystems.com/BSDnow. So check it out. Yep. You can even download a free guide that will give you information on purchasing a server for open source and what to know going into it.
Yeah.
So just some good information there for you.
What questions to ask and things like that. Because, even if you're already sold, if you have to convince management, if you have this list of questions, you can be like, well, what are the other guys going to do about this? And they're like, well, they're not. So, yeah. And that's why we buy all of our stuff from IX Systems.
Okay, we're joined today by Luke Marsden, the CEO of Hybrid Cluster. So thank you so much for being on the show with us today, Luke.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Excellent. So same thing we ask everybody. So first, give us a little bit about the background of yourself. How'd you get involved with BSD? What was the road that got you to this point?
Sure. So... about 12 years ago, when I was 15, I started a little hosting company with a friend of mine. And little did I know what would come of that. Mm-hmm. We were just doing sort of standard shared hosting for people all over the world. But because we were hackers, we built the whole system ourselves. And we early on decided to start using FreeBSD, rock solid server operating system. At the time, and still is, a really good alternative to Linux. And then I went to, I was fortunate enough to study computer science at Oxford University here in England. Mm-hmm. And so I was running the hosting company and studying theoretical computer science at the same time. When I finished my degree, I realized that, throughout my degree, we had problems in the hosting company, and we were constantly battling outages and downtime and scaling problems and so on. And so when I finished my degree, I said, I'm going to try and fix this. I'm going to try and build a platform that is a fundamentally better way of doing hosting. Mm-hmm. And so out of that came the desire to sort of build Hybrid Cluster. And we carried on using FreeBSD and so here we are today.
Cool. So I guess that segues perfectly into our next question. What exactly is Hybrid Cluster?
Well, it's a great question. I think of it as a fundamentally better way of building a cloud. Mm-hmm. And that might be sort of a vague way of defining it, but I can be a little bit more specific. There's when I was looking at technologies to use to try and improve the situation we had in the hosting company around 2008, I looked around and I realized that the way that the industry was doing it with virtualization and shared storage was A, it was too expensive for us, and B, it just didn't seem like the most efficient way of hosting web applications.
Sure.
And I realized, hey, well, I think I can do better. I think I can do better with containers and distributed storage. And so I found ZFS or ZFS, depending on your preferences for pronunciation.
Zed.
I'll get it started.
I just say ZFS because it's what the authors call it.
You're a disgrace to your country.
Arbitrary. So anyway, whatever we call it, the file system that will not be named, I discovered ZFS and realized that actually the semantics that ZFS gives you for snapshotting and send and receive would be great building blocks for building a asynchronously replicated distributed file system. Mm-hmm. And set about thinking, well, that's got to be easy, right? 4 years later, we'd done what we thought would take about a year in terms of R&D, but we'd built a pretty robust replication system on top of that. So basically the way it works is that every application that's running inside Hybrid Cluster is running in a container. It's typically either a chroot or a jail, depending on the application type. And those containers are backed onto ZFS file systems. And each time the container is modified, every time the file system is written to, our system will take a new snapshot and replicate that snapshot out to other machines in the cluster. So it keeps them all sort of almost like a live backup. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the replication layer. It's built on top of ZFS. It's sort of like an alternative to SAN. You can think of it like a virtual SAN. Then on top of that, yeah, we use containers. We'll talk about jails a bit more later, I think. Mm-hmm. But using containers is sort of a more efficient way of alternative to something like VMware. And then on top of that, we built a proxying layer in Twisted, which is a Python networking framework. And altogether, the system means that you get high availability. So if a server fails, then the system will automatically fail over the jails or the containers that were running on that server onto other servers that have replicas. You get auto-scaling, which means that if a jail or a container gets a spike in traffic, then the system will automatically live migrate other containers away from that server onto quieter servers. And you also get this data vault feature, or internally we call it the time machine, but we don't want Apple's lawyers on us. So
sure.
We're calling it the data vault. And that just exposes this web interface to users so they can say, hey, show me what my jail looked like 10 minutes ago or 2 hours ago, or show me what my mailbox looked like last Thursday at 5 o'clock.
Right.
Something like that.
Oh, very cool.
So how do you do live migration of a jail?
Good question. So we do live migration of a jail using a couple of tricks. So what we're doing, if you imagine the system has the replication system underneath with ZFS file system per application. Mm-hmm. It has the container sitting on top of that ZFS file system. And then it's got our proxying layer sitting on top of that. So every request that comes in the top of the system goes through the proxying layer. And it might hit the proxying layer on a different machine and then get reverse proxied over to the correct current backend for that mm-hmm. application. So mm-hmm. if you want to send an application from one server to another, what we do is we manipulate the proxy layer and the application layer at the same time. So we pause incoming requests momentarily for that application.
Sure.
So if it's a web application, we just start pausing new incoming requests, HTTP requests. We let those in-flight requests complete. So Apache or PHP or whatever that's running inside the jail will send its response back to the users for those in-flight requests. Then the file system's quiescent. So at that point, we unmount it, we take a new snapshot, we do a ZFS send and receive over to the catcher. So the metaphor we use is throwers and catchers. Mm-hmm. So the thrower takes the last snapshot, does a new replication of that snapshot over to the catcher. The catcher mounts the file system, sets up the application, boots the jail, and then we unleash the requests that we're building up on the throw as awesome proxy onto the catcher, and the user doesn't even notice that anything happened. We can do a live migration like that in under a second.
Cool.
Oh, that's really impressive.
I guess as long as you don't have any long live requests or anything, but
that's so. Right. Yeah, no, sure. I mean, so long lived requests give you a choice. You can either abort the live migration if you have long lived requests, or you can say, actually, you know, this live migration is important enough that I'm going to break that request right. and hope that the client retries or the mm-hmm. user reloads the page or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Well, I assume since you guys are talking a lot about JL, ZFS, you're running this all on FreeBSD, and you guys are all big BSD fans over there. Are you doing any others?
So we're FreeBSD completely start to finish. Uh-huh. The operating system that we deploy, you can download the ISO from our website. The operating system that you deploy when you install Hybrid Cluster is a slightly modified version of FreeBSD 9.2 stable. We've got one of our engineers is Andre Gapon, who's an excellent FreeBSD kernel developer. He's been amazingly helpful at helping us fix lots of issues that we've had over the last couple of years with it and feeding those back to the community. But yeah, so you download this slightly modified ISO, and then you can just install it on some hardware or even on a VM, and you can use our web interface to load it up our software and turn it up into a cluster.
Cool.
Very cool.
So I guess, what kind of services does Hybrid Cluster actually offer?
So we sell licenses to use software, basically. Mm-hmm. It's $160 per server per month. We sell support on top of that. So yeah, that's how we work.
Hmm. So you kind of touched on this, but what are all the areas in which you use FreeBSD at the company? I know you're using Jails, ZFS, and there are any other specific bits that you need to use FreeBSD for?
Yeah, so do you mean any other specific bits of FreeBSD that we use?
Yeah, or that or
anything that would be specific to FreeBSD.
Sure. So we run all our production systems for our own sort of internal management and so on. On top of FreeBSD, we eat all our own dog food, basically. So all our mail, all our websites are running on Hybrid Cluster. And our deployment system that we use to create new clusters, so we've sort of got like one master cluster that creates lots of little baby clusters. And yeah, all of that is FreeBSD with ZFS, OpenZFS, Jails. Beyond that, we also use a ton of other open source software, but which I'll mention a bit later. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, we currently use both PF and IPFW, although I'd like to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I won't get into that.
I guess it's not on that list of questions, but how interesting would RelayD be for you guys, that new reverse proxy that's built into OpenBSD? There's some effort to port it over to FreeBSD, but one of the new features it has is the ability to spoof the from address instead of having to do something like an X44 header when you're reverse proxying HTTP. So you could also reverse proxy protocols that don't have the ability to inject a little header like that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll check that out.
Yes.
Anything we can do to make Awesome Proxy faster is generally interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty fast already. It's just like shoving data around between buffers, but it would be quite cool to be able to like splice TCP connections together at the kernel
level. That's
so
actually something that RelayD does. And I know, I can't remember his name now, the guy that does a lot of the ZFS stuff, not Powell or the, what the hell's his name?
Not Matt. Presumably.
No, the other guy.
For FreeBSD?
Yes.
Like Jin Lee or something?
No. Who is it? The guy that gave the presentation at EuroBSDCon 2012.
Oh, like I can remember far back he was.
I wasn't there.
Yeah. I can't remember his name. Anyway, he got a start at porting it, but some of the stuff requires new kernel stuff, like the ability to display sockets together. So it'd be really cool to see that come.
Hey, yeah, it would be great if we could do that from userland as well. Mm-hmm. Through Python, if we could figure out how to do some Python bindings for that sort of stuff, we could definitely make use of bits of that technology in our awesome proxy.
Yeah, I think it just gets in OpenBSD. I'm pretty sure it's exposed just through the socket API. So,
okay, cool.
Where were we?
So, yeah.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what it was like developing this distributed storage platform?
Yeah, that was tough. Mm-hmm. Turns out there's a lot of edge cases,
mm-hmm.
but we pretty much nailed them all now. It's interesting. I mean, so basically, if you look at the semantics that ZFS gives you for, like, take a snapshot, send it over here, receive it here, you can roll back snapshots, and so it sort of gives you these primitives. And then the way that you would build a replication system sort of falls out of that, if mm-hmm. you know what I mean. And through a lot of trial and error, as well as some careful design, we discovered all of the edge cases, like what happens if a slave happens to be ahead of a master, then you have to stash the head of the slave and so on. So we built this way of thinking about the global state of a file system across many servers when it's had ZFS send and receive done on it. Mm-hmm. And we build these objects called snapshot graphs. So a snapshot graph is a directed acyclic graph of snapshot nodes, and a snapshot node just represents the state of a file system at a certain point in space and time, if that makes sense. So we've got this data on this server identified by its IP address at this timestamp. And so you can build a DAG of these. And then you can traverse that graph in order to do things like figuring out how to deal with network partition scenarios and mm-hmm. how to recover from that and just how to make replication work in all of the different cases.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun. It was great.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, so you mentioned you're using ZFS and Jails. Are there any new features that you're looking forward to? Like ZFS is getting like bookmarking for ZFS replication and... hopefully soon, ZFS send being able to resume.
Oh,
yes.
Thank you. Yes.
Definitely. So the bookmarking feature, I was quite excited to hear about that actually. I think that gives us the opportunity to do replication without necessarily keeping the snapshots.
Yes, that's how I understand it.
So,
if you understand it better, we'd love if you'd explain it to us.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness, no, Andre would be able to, okay. But I think I'm not even sure I'm going to try. Okay. It's something to do with if you just store the pointer.
Right, it allows you to do the incremental replication without having to keep the original snapshot.
Yeah, I think so. It doesn't. Mm. It means you don't have to keep the things before. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
it's black magic, basically.
Yeah. We're just consumers of ZFS, right. But it's awesome, and we couldn't do what we do without it. So, yeah, the features that I'm most excited about in ZFS coming up actually are, well, one of them's already landed, is the write smoothing feature,
mm-hmm.
Which mm-hmm. makes it, when a machine is under load, it smooths out, or when a pool is under write load, it smooths out the latency of those writes so that the, to avoid the effect that previously happened where sometimes the universe would just sort of grind to a halt for 5 seconds and then carry on,
sure.
then grind to a halt again.
Yep.
So that's really, really good. It's mostly around performance, actually, and the other one is, let's see, there's a lot of work is being done at Delphix at the moment on fragmentation and
yes.
dealing better with fragmented pools, and I'm really excited to see that land. We've already seen the first fruits of it with the histogram stuff that's now in head, but we're going to be tracking that very, very eagerly because at the moment we daren't fill our pools more than 60% full.
Yeah, same thing here. And so when we got to talk to George about that, the histogram feature, we're quite excited about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very cool. So what features are you guys contributing back to OpenZFS that you guys have done?
So Yeah, most of the work is actually around porting features from Illumos and helping to accelerate the integration of those features into FreeBSD. So we've ported, Andre ported the write smoothing fix into our private tree before upstreaming it to FreeBSD, and that's landed now. And a little while ago, he also ported the libzfs core stuff. And that was around being able to do operations that previously took multiple transaction groups in a single transaction group, I think, which helped nail a whole class of reliability bugs. We've also just contributed a lot of stability fixes back. So Andre's been fantastic at figuring out, like, when I first got to know him, I'd just send him a core dump and say, help. and he'd figure out the bug and fix it and commit it to FreeBSD, and we've been doing that for some time. And at the moment, there's a project underway, actually. Andre's written a stress test tool which does sort of standard ZPL operations to the file system, like renaming directories while files are open inside them and all this sort of stuff concurrently in order to sort of stress test ZFS, and we found managed to break it in quite a few new interesting ways, which we're now fixing. And actually, Andre's sort of partway through a fairly major rewrite of the ZPL on FreeBSD, which is exciting.
I wonder if that touches at VBSDCon. Adrian Chad was saying that when they ran Poudriere, everything was fine on the 24-core machine, but when they moved it to a 32-core machine, there was just enough stuff happening at once to cause really interesting bugs.
Ah, that's nice. Yeah, a friend of mine recommended once, if we wanted to really stress test some kernels, just run far too many VMs on a machine at once, because it'll sort of trigger the same sort of...
I wonder if that's what I'm seeing on my Poudriere system here, where it corrupts the Z pool if I have all the processes going simultaneously.
How many cores do you have?
It's only a 16-core, so I don't know why, but it's happened twice in 3 weeks now.
My 24-core machine hasn't had any trouble, but...
Okay.
I'm not compiling the entire port tree either. I'm doing like a subset of like 250 ports that I need.
We had a really interesting bug with a 48-core machine where it turns out the timer interrupts across all of those CPUs all at the same time, with the default timer settings starved the CPU of any time to actually run userland processes. So, but we fixed that by changing the timer to LAPIC. So, it's fun games.
Yep,
cool.
And then I guess it's what other open source technologies were you making use of? You said you would come back to that question earlier.
Oh, sure, yeah. So Twisted is a huge one. The Twisted Python networking framework makes it possible to write sane networking code. Using callbacks and deferreds, and we're really, really lucky to have some of the best minds in the Twisted community working with us now. And so then Python, of course, and we wouldn't be where we are today without, of course, Apache, MySQL, and PHP, and Bind, and XIM, and Dovecot, So yeah, that's sort of the complete stack, and those communities have been awesome, especially Twisted and OpenZFS.
Anything else you'd like to mention as we wrap up?
Just one thing: we are about to announce, and in fact, will already be announced on our website by the time this airs, the availability of free non-commercial licenses for Hybrid Cluster. So, got it here first.
Very cool.
You're very welcome to come to our website, download our ISO. We've got install instructions on our docs, docs.hybridcluster.com, for installing it on bare metal or on virtualized infrastructures. And please kick the tires, try it out, and give us a call.
Cool. I guess one more surprise question. How are you guys looking forward to FreeBSD 10, and what do you see as your challenges and schedule for upgrading to using that?
So I'm not sure what the latest is on Xen DOM 0 support in FreeBSD 10. Maybe you guys know, But that's what I got really excited about when I saw it.
Right.
I guess
I saw Beehive 40 more patches go in for the DOM 0 support, so something's happening.
Okay. That's good news. Well, if that works, that would be really interesting, mm-hmm. because then we could, like, go crazy and run Windows on top of Hyper Cluster or whatever.
I'm sorry.
Which the, some people want.
No, this was DOM U, not DOM 0, sorry.
Oh, okay.
I was just making it run better in Zen, not being able to host.
Well, that's also important. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. I guess most of the activity is focused on Beehive at the moment then in terms
I wonder if we'll get Beehive running Windows first or DOM 0.
Well, hopefully we can answer that question next week. Or, sorry, next week in actual time, which will actually have already been done by the time this airs, so never mind.
It will have been answered already. Yes. Whoa,
thank
my
goodness
mind
we answered
is
that
fried.
Question 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Very cool. Great. Well, thank you so much, Luke. Anything else? Any other tidbit you want to throw out there before we sign off?
No, just thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Looking forward to seeing you at BSDCamp.
Yep.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Luke, and appreciate you having you on the show this week.
There are times when you want to securely share files with your friends, but you don't want them to have shell access to your server. So OpenSSH includes SFTP, the Secure File Transfer Protocol, that provides both authentication and encryption. Normally, you need to give a user an SSH, like a full shell, login for them to be able to transfer files via SFTP. But there's a useful feature that allows you to disallow shell access and only allow them to run the one certain binary, in this case SFTP, so that they could only do the one thing that you want. What's more, you can lock them to a certain directory with the chroot so that they can't browse outside of that and browse the rest of the system. So this tutorial will show you how to do just that and get started. So we're assuming you already have your SSHD set up. It's, you know, set up by default in most cases, but we'll make a couple of changes. So first we need to create a new user. So we'll do add user. And we'll set their shell to no login, so they're not able to log in by default. Create their home directory. Set up a password. They'll also be able to use an SSH key after the fact, so we can do that. We won't lock out the account. That looks good. So now, we can see we have this GNUB user. So now we can edit our etc SSH SSHD config, and this is where you can change all your options for your SSH daemon. There are quite a few to pick from. But in particular, what we'll do is go all the way to the bottom and create a new match directive. So we'll match on the user GNUB, and we'll set some specific options that will only apply to users that have this name, or you can match on a bunch of other parameters as well. But in this case, that's what we want. So we'll chroot this user to %h, which is an automatic value for their home directory. We'll also allow password authentication. This can be important if you've disabled password authentication on your whole server. You can allow it for just this one user. Or you can disallow it once you have them set up with an SSH key. You can use force command to only allow them to run the one thing instead of being able to get a shell. And we'll disable X11 and TCP forwarding, so they can't do any of that. So now we can have our SSHD reload the config. So now if we look at create a directory, which should have been done by the add user. I'm not sure what happened there. We'll create a files directory that they'll have access to. And so now you can try to give your friend SFTP login, and they'll log in. So if we do SFTP as gnub localhost, if we do ls, we can see they have this files directory. And inside there, they can upload stuff like so we just uploaded a file. Now, if they tried SSH as that user, they get, this service allows SFTP connections only, and they get disconnected. Or if we go back to SSH, or SFTP, we see there's our directory listing, but if we try to go up a directory, we're still in the same place. We try to go to somewhere, there's no such directory to go to. They're locked in their home directory and they can never leave. And that's how you lock it down. If you man sshd config, you can learn more about some of the other directives that you can use. So with a match, you can match on a bunch of different things. Allow groups. What else do they have in here? So list the things you can use inside a match directive. Whether certain users or groups are allowed, what the authorized keys command is, so you can authenticate against external parameters or whatever. You can present a different banner, chroot, obviously, force command like we did. Max sessions, so you can limit certain users to being logged in only so many times. Whether or not certain users are allowed to log in with no password, which you should never do. And plenty of other things like that.
Okay, next up, our weekly news roundup. We're going to mention some stuff real quick and just go at you rapid fire here. So first up, FreeBSD on OpenStack. So what's going on with that, Alan?
So the new tool has been released on GitHub called CloudInit. Mm-hmm. It's not quite a complete solution to run FreeBSD instances on CloudStack, but it's quite a start.
It's progressing there, sure.
Yeah. We mentioned in the SAS report that there's a group working on making FreeBSD and Beehive be able to host machines on CloudStack, but these are the tools so that when you run FreeBSD in CloudStack, whether that's on a Linux host or a FreeBSD host, you have all the same capabilities you have with a Linux guest. Cool. So basically, it adds itself to rc.local and evokes CloudInit on the first boot and pulls down all the stuff you need, you know, automatic SSH host key generation, setting up your key so you can log in, enlarge the root partition so that you can make a generic image that you can stamp out to any virtual machine, and then it'll resize itself to whatever size storage you did. So, you know, you can make one small image and then deploy that to a bunch of different size virtual machines, and it'll just auto-scale out to fit.
Nice.
Okay. Piping the console messages from the BSD machine back into the OpenStack console log so that, you know, when errors come up in a virtual machine, they'll actually go into the OpenStack console log so they can be aggregated and stuff. It will remove itself from the startup process, after it runs and does, you know, your SSH public key injection and all that other stuff. It can also, clean up stuff, download and install, and all the stuff. And so they have the build image where you can grab it for put it on your Glance, which is the OpenStack storage system. Mm-hmm. And they have an image you can try out to see it working, and they have all the cool stuff.
Neat.
And in our notes here, we also mentioned that it's about the same idea as what we talked with Colin about the other week, where he built something very similar for the Amazon EC2 platform. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see FreeBSD getting the love it needs to take over the cloud as well.
Yes, yes. Cloud domination is pending. Okay, next up we have FOSDEM, I guess, was a couple weeks back, and they've started uploading a bunch of their videos.
Actually, yeah.
1 week ago?
It was okay. The 1st and 2nd of February.
Oh, there you go. Okay. But they had 7 BSD presentations at FOSDEM, so that's cool. It's neat to see that number going up, hopefully, every year.
Yeah.
And they are slowly updating videos. So we'll have the link at video.fosdem.org/2014, so you can go check those out, see what you think.
They had FreeNAS development by John Hickson, DTrace integration, the Edge BSD project, porting FreeBSD on Zen to ARM. Which is interesting, so that FreeBSD could be a guest on Zen on ARM.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
What's new in FreeBSD 10 by Paul Schenkfeld, and FreeBSD moving towards ports version 2 by Baptiste Drusson.
Oh, okay. I have to go watch that and see what he's got in store for us in the future here.
His subtitle for that was Trimming the Biggest Bonsai.
Oh, no. All right, well, cool. Yeah. I guess we'll mention, too, the BSD dev room was full at FOSDEM, so lots of interest in what's going on from the other communities as well. So that's good to see. BSD is alive and well out at FOSDEM.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, next up, we have the FreeBSD challenge is returning. So what happened with that, Alan?
Well, we covered it a little while ago. A series of blog posts when I was going to take the challenge and run FreeBSD for 30 days. Holidays and stuff tend to mess up anybody's plans to do something for 30 days in a row. And so after I was like, well, whatever happened to that? We were going to maybe check in and see what he's up to now. And he's like, oh, he hasn't done stuff in a while. But we harangued him and he's going to get back to it. And so we're looking forward to seeing more posts as he's on, I think, day 11 of 30.
Okay.
So we're hoping to see more from that soon.
Keep on going, and we'll keep. We'll be interested to see what your findings are. Maybe give us some ideas moving forward. Cool. I guess this time he outlines the upgrade process going from 9 to 10 as well, using FreeBSD update and some notes about different options for upgrading ports, extra tips, etc. So check out the link post show.
He's got day 11 and 12 have already been posted, so you can check those out and keep an eye on it.
Maybe by the time this airs, we'll have a few more days up there. So, very cool. All right, next up, just some PCBSD news, the weekly tidbits there. So, since we did our big 10.0 release a couple weeks back, now we're pretty much kind of shifting focus a little bit. Instead of rewriting major parts of it for 10.1, we're really in a fine-tuning phase, and we're encouraging users to submit usability bugs, UI bugs, any little things that you'd like to see polished up for 10.1. We're trying to get those in as fast as possible so that we can then tackle some bigger issues, knowing that all those are taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
This last week, we've pushed out some updates for 10.0 release, including the first Edge package set is available. So if you want to be on more of a bleeding edge set of packages, you can now pull those. We're going to update those about every week to 2 weeks is what we're shooting for, 10 days-ish. And so you can stay a little more current with the port street if you're into that kind of thing.
Cool.
And we did some fixes to make the PBI format shrink packages down a little bit better. And
it says here approximately 50% smaller.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you did?
Well, we trimmed out a lot of fat, but one of the biggest things was PackageNG was caching a lot of stuff inside the PBI directory.
Ah.
So we nuked that, and it was like, oh, okay, that saved up a lot of space. So
I'm looking forward to saving that space on my mirrors.
Yes, yes. So, as a matter of fact, I already started deleting a bunch of the bigger ones and replacing them with their smaller counterparts. So,
Anyway,
those will be pushing out in the upcoming weeks. We've already started doing that for some of the new browsers and stuff.
Awesome.
So that's what we got going on right now. And again, you know, hit our bug database. If there's anything that you want to see fixed or improved or ideas that you want looked at for 10.1, this is the time to get them in so we can start working on them early, anticipating 10.1 maybe later in the spring/summer.
Yeah. Well, at NYC BSDCon, there were, I think, about 40% of the people had never been to a BSD conference before. And a lot of them were like Linux DevOps type people.
Sure.
And so I think we convinced quite a few of them to try PCBSD, as Drew was handing out PCBSD 10 CDs.
Oh, fantastic.
And
it's a good way to get your feet wet on the BSD platform.
Exactly.
It's just much quicker to get up and running and get to a usable workstation.
It's the kind of environment they expect coming from Linux, but underneath you still have all the power of BSD.
Sure. Matter of fact, we've been able to fool some people. You can put PCBSD on their box, just change the background wallpaper. And they think it's a Linux box until they start digging into the command prompt. I'm like, oh, this is
unless you
BSD.
Dig into the command prompt, you know, KDE is KDE, buddy.
Yeah, right? So that's cool. Excellent. Okay, well, that's our weekly news roundup. So I guess we'll go ahead and get into some feedback and questions from you guys in the audience. All right, first up on our feedback section this week, we have something from Derek about FreeBSD on a VPS. So first, he wanted to ask our thoughts on whether there's any benefit to running FreeBSD, particularly 10 release, on a VPS where the host is Linux, particularly in something like a KVM host scenario like DigitalOcean, or is this adding unnecessary overhead when you're still essentially running Linux underneath? So he's not totally sure how KVM works, but he was thinking the guest OS, if it's a Linux distro, will not need its own kernel, but a BSD would need its own kernel. Will a BSD derive less benefit on top of KVM host than would a Linux guest, or is this still worthwhile outright, or is it worthwhile contingent on some minimum system resources?
So with KVM, you're using hardware virtualization. So you're bypassing most of the OS underneath.
Sure.
And with KVM, pretty sure all guests have their own kernel. It's only Xen in one certain mode where you're sharing a kernel.
Sure.
So in most cases, there's, you know, you get all the advantages of FreeBSD. So yes, you can run FreeBSD.
Yes, you want to do that.
A few VPS providers don't provide FreeBSD or the right management tools and stuff. But in general, it's worth running it, and there's not really any disadvantage.
Okay, so that's a good, easy question. Yes, do it.
Yes.
There you go.
Done. FreeBSD everywhere.
That's right. So next up from Sean, in a recent episode of BSD Now, Alan, I guess you informed the viewing and listening audience that you're using OpenSSH 6.4 on your system and you obtained it from the ports tree. So he's asking where he can update that on his machines.
So it's under the security category, and it's OpenSSH-Portable, which is the version that OpenBSD makes for other operating systems, right? So they have OpenSSH for OpenBSD, and then they make OpenSSH-Portable that works on Linux and FreeBSD and all the other OSs.
Okay.
And actually, in the ports tree, that is now 6.5.
Oh, hey. And if you're running on a package NG system somewhere or pulling from a repo, you could probably just package add that as well.
Exactly. There's two versions of the package now. There's OpenSSH-Portable, which installs it, or there's OpenSSH-Portable-Base, which overwrites the version of OpenSSH that comes with FreeBSD with the one from the package. The default package installs it under user local, so when you type SSH, by default it's the system SSH, not the package SSH. You have to change your path variables around or manually specify which one to run. For the server, the config files are in a different place, and you know you can change instead of SSH underscore enable, you put OpenSSH underscore enable to get it to run. But the config files are in a different place, and you might want to copy your keys. Otherwise, if you upgrade but don't copy the keys, then the new one will generate its own keys, and then you'll get the big scary warning that that's not the machine you're expecting.
Cool. His second question, though, what is your opinion on tools like NSLookup and Dig being removed from 10 because it was a part of Bind, with the whole switch over to Unbound?
NSLookup has been deprecated by Bind for the last 10 years. It's not the tool you should use ever.
So we're just catching up to what they've already recommended.
Well, they still include it, but they recommend you don't use that for the last 10 years. For Dig, there's a similar tool built into 10 now called Drill, but obviously it's not quite the same. There's a port, I think, called like Bind Utils or something that gives you just those tools that you would expect.
Sure. Without having to install them back if you really need them.
Or if you're, you know, have some script that requires them or something, you can get them. Yes, I'm sure I will type Dig a couple of times on a 10 box and be like, why is that not working?
Oops,
and then remember, I know why that's not working.
So just remember that. Dig is now Drill, but with different stuff happening.
Yep.
Okay, well, cool.
I would think in general, Bind being removed as part of base was a good thing because...
Oh, yeah.
I don't have the stats in front of me now, but when I looked, it was like 17%.
3 out of 5. Yeah. Security patches or something.
17% of all of the patches in the last 10 years have been because of Bind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been a lot recently too. Yep. Bind this, bind that. So, exactly. Yeah, it's a good deal. I'm glad it's been replaced as well.
Yep.
Cool. So next up we have Patrick. So I'll let you read this one, Alan. Yeah,
so he's got a couple of questions.
he sent you a document. Yeah, it wasn't really a question.
Yeah, there's just a lot in here. But we'll skip to the interesting part. He's done a successful update with the EasyJail documentation to update the base jail and then so on. He was wondering why you should update the base jail after updating this, the host system. And it's because when you reboot the host system, you're going to be on the new kernel. And if you update the world first, if the size of certain structs and stuff have changed, then it can cause things like top and PS to not work anymore. And when PS doesn't work, you can have all kinds of fun trying to figure out what's going on in your system. So that's why you always upgrade your kernel first and then run that kernel and then upgrade the world. And then he also says he's been using the new PKG tool on his system. And when he goes to install Postgres, he gets offered all 5 versions of Postgres.
Sure.
And he's like, how do I specify which one you want? The best way with package to specify a specific port is to use the what's called the origin, which is the name from the ports tree. So that includes the category. So, you know, databases slash Postgres SQL 9.0 will install that.
That's how we reference all ours to, you know, www/Firefox or whatever, because you know, that's where it came from.
Also, Baptiste and the package manager team have been working on getting rid of what those are package name collisions, so there'll be an easy way to specify which one to install. Because in older versions of package and before the project to update the ports infrastructure for it, if you said package install subversion, it would try to install 1.6, 1.7, and 1.8 at the same time and then fail because they would have conflicting files.
Yep.
And then he raises a similar question about ports with that are substring matches for something he's trying to install. And again, you can do that using the port origin. If you do package search minus O, it'll list the origin name instead of the package name when you're doing the search, and that will tell you what name to actually install. It can be very confusing with Python ports because the port name is py-something, but the package name is py27-. So that in the future, if that was compiled with Python 3, it would be py3-. But the package name is, or the port name origin is py-whatever. And so, yeah, I've seen people have trouble with that. And so if you do your package search.
Same thing with a QT. It's like the port will be QT4 mock, but then the command's mock-QT4. It's just everything's backwards.
Yeah. So if you do your search with the minus O flag, it'll give you the origin, which is how you can select what to install more easily.
Cool. Okay. I think you answered his questions there.
So next.
Good deal. Next up, we have Peter. So he's asking about a FreeBSD in Samba. So again, it's a long email, but basically he's trying to set up running Samba using LDAP and Active Directory. So just being straight up with you, Peter, Alan and I, neither one of us are really big Active Directory or LDAP guys.
Yeah,
so.
I've done a little bit of LDAP, would have been like 6 years ago now.
But we just had somebody send a tutorial in, is what you said, Alan, the other day?
Yes, we just got a tutorial about like FreeBSD or FreeNAS and LDAP and stuff. And so in a future episode, we expect to cover that with lots of detail. And hopefully that will be able to answer your question.
Yes. And we'll, I think we'll have the post to this, the link to this question up on the show afterwards. Yep. So if somebody in the audience would like to chime in, give us an answer to what he's specifically trying to do with LDAP, that would be helpful. We'll pass that along to him.
Yep. Although, you know, looking at what he's doing, I know that FreeNAS, it makes it easier to do what he's looking at, but you know, anyway.
Yeah, maybe that's not his use case, though.
So yes, we're hoping to have a tutorial on how to do that soon.
Okay, cool. And we'll be learning from that, too, because like I said, neither one of us really done it a lot. So, okay, next up we have from Sean, a ZFS question, another document that got sent to Alan. But it looks like what he's trying to do here, just do incremental backups.
Yeah, so he's trying to do, he says he's been pulling his hair out trying to do incremental ZFS backups. So he watches BSD now, and he was pleasantly surprised when he saw my name next to the ZX4 port, which is a port specifically for doing incremental backups or snapshotting and replicating. the port we use to replicate the PCBSD package repo.
Cool.
So he's got a root on ZFS pool that's a 120 gig SSD, and then a backup pool, which is a 1 terabyte SATA drive. And he's trying to do his backups of his root pool to the backup pool every day with incremental backups using ZFS snapshots. He'd like to keep up to a year's worth of snapshots on the backup pool, but only one or two of the snapshots on the root pool. In ZXFer, there's a command for protecting grandfathers, and basically that allows you to keep the older snapshots. Also, it's not available yet, but OpenZFS is working on a feature called bookmarks that allow you to have snapshots where the original, to do incremental sends of a snapshot even when the original snapshot doesn't exist anymore or something like that.
Sure.
It's work they're doing in order to be able to get around to doing ZFS sends that can be resumed when they're interrupted. But that should help as well.
Hasn't hit yet. Yeah, it should help. I'm not sure what.
But yeah, if you're using ZXFer, you want to look at the minus G flag, and that's where you can specify a snapshot older than this many days should not be deleted, even though it doesn't exist on the parent anymore.
Sure.
And the other thing to make sure is, like, I see when you have some examples. I don't know if this is exactly what you're doing or your examples, but you can't reuse your snapshot names. The snapshots have to be unique. So I use a port ZFS-snapshot-mgmt to manage my snapshots and automatically call the old ones and stuff. But that uses Ruby, which is fine for me because I have Puppet and stuff. But if you're not, if you look in the sysutils, there's a couple other ones that are written. There's one that's written in like plain shell. And so it won't have any dependencies that way. And it allows you to do the similar thing.
Nice.
So, yeah, if you can set up your snapshots to happen automatically, and then you can replicate it with ZXFer, and then you can use the grandfather protection, which will say, if a snapshot's more than this old, I don't actually want to delete it off the old pool. So that you can do things like what we do is we take a snapshot of the pool every 15 minutes and replicate that, and we only keep those 15-minute snapshots for, like, 6 hours. And then only the ones that happened at the top of the hour are kept for, like, 3 days. And then only the ones at midnight and noon are kept for a week. And then we only keep, you know, one day a week for a month and things like that. So
sure,
we can grandfather out and just keep a very small subsection of the patches so that we can roll back or, more importantly, to have a place to replicate from, right? Without wasting as much disk space.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And if you have ideas for more improvements or better docs for ZXFer, let me know. And I do plan on working on that some more.
Cool. Okay, well, excellent. Well, that should answer Sean's question there.
Yep.
So as usual, we want to mention that all the tutorials, everything's going to be posted in its entirety at bsdnow.tv. So if you're listening to the show or watching it elsewhere, go hit the main website. You can find all the little things we're referencing there.
Yep.
Last week's NTP tutorial also got a small update. So if you're running a LAN-only server, as well as a couple links on how to turn it into a Stratum 1 server with a GPS device.
Yeah.
Ooh, cool.
The LAN one is interesting. It basically, you can have the server send out a broadcast that all the clients are listening for. So instead of having, you know, 1,000 machines inside your LAN all hammering the time server on a regular basis, you can just have the time server send out a broadcast or a multicast saying, it is this time, and then everybody will receive that and be like, oh, okay.
Everyone who's listening. Yeah. Yes. That is cool.
Also, the SSH tutorial got a bunch of updates for OpenSSH 6.5 when it was released, and playing with the new key types and stuff.
Oh, fantastic. So also, send your questions, comments, show ideas, topics, or if you have any stories you want mentioned on the show, to feedback@bsdnow.tv, and we'll try and get to that and either put it in a future episode or mention it on the air. Also, you can watch live Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern or 1900 UTC.
Yep, we'll be back to our regular schedule after this week's.
Yeah, this week was
bouncing around, but yeah.
Most weeks, that's when we're on the air. Yep. And lastly, we want to mention BSD Now t-shirts are close to being ready.
Yes.
Stay tuned.
We'll have a design is just being finalized. And then, we expect to have those on sale in March.
Fantastic. Cool. Get them just in time. Well, I don't know. Probably after Asia,
probably
right?
After Asia.
Okay. Well, we can get them. We can wear them BSD pants.
Yes. How about that?
Cool. Okay. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed the show this week. We look forward to seeing you guys next week.